Welcome back, folks, to episode 67 of the Running Man Self-Regulation Skills Project podcast with me, your host, Dr. Armando Dominguez, PhD in health psychology, licensed professional counselor, and an adjunct professor at a local community college. And what I'd like to discuss today, in today's podcast, is the cost of attention. Attention is something that's always on. It's something that often we hear people say something like, pay attention, or you're not paying attention. Pay more attention. Let me get your attention. This sort of thing, as if it somehow wavers and is on and off like a switch. And this couldn't be further from the truth. Our attention does not turn off. Actually, it's always on because we're always in a state of perception. Even whenever we seem to blank out, that is more the social scheme where it seems like we're not being attentive, in quotes, to somebody and attending to them in a manner that they would consider appropriate, respectful, this sort of thing. So what are we talking about when we say attention? Often, whenever we are attentive, we are realizing that the signals coming in from our immediate environment are being interpreted and we're aware and often pay attention to and act on those things once we judge them as useful, dangerous, helpful, or something that we can eat, this sort of thing. So it's a very simplistic thing. But the fact is, attention is something that we can consciously direct, but at the same time, we can very consciously direct it away from what we would consider something important, such as when people say, in quotes, you're not focusing, you lack focus, and this is something that is also levied harshly upon people that are identified as having attention deficit disorder, ADHD, attention deficit with hyperactivity disorder, and other neurological states that often get misdiagnosed or misaligned or even set into the confines of what we'd call on spectrum for autism. So being careful with the term attention is required, but let us get into, well, what is it and what does it do for us? Because there's some details we really must pay attention to. One of the simplest ways to determine whether or not somebody is attentive is to determine if we're observing someone else from the outside. We're a third person or second person observer, and we're paying attention to how someone is interacting and whether or not they're engaging, whether it be with something they're manipulating or grasping with their hands, or if they're doing something they seem to be, for the most part, moving in a direction that seems to have a goal of sorts, like completion of a task, this sort of thing. So attentiveness generally is counted or measured as a behavior that appears to be goal-directed, appears to have a direction of sorts, and if we can interpret it that way, we tend to say that somebody has attention or focus. And that may or may not be particularly correct, except for that paradigm, such as in a learning environment where a teacher is teaching a student and they're not interested. So interest has a lot to do with attention because those things that are environmentally safe or engaging or novel often will draw our attentiveness in the direction of whatever it is that is novel, interesting, or different, or possibly dangerous. So the fact that we pay attention indicates that somehow we're intentionally trying to. And if there's something interesting, yes, we do. But what if we're not intending to be attentive at all? What if we're just walking around outdoors in nature and we have a whole new forest we've never walked into? How overwhelming can that be whenever you're trying to pay attention to all of it and every little detail? Well, that description makes it sound like an overwhelming task because if we did it that way, yes, it would be. But if we take into consideration that we tend to take information in as a whole, at the visual level, a gestalt. Now, are you hearing things? Yes, more likely you're hearing birds and leaves and the wind and your feet in the grass, this sort of thing. So you have a lot of perceptual information coming in. But also that's something that not only takes attention, but also costs us energy to provide that attention to those things in interpretation of those very signals. So very important detail to pay attention to there. If we pay attention to what the folks that do Zen meditation have written about for years, and I will be referring to Miyamoto Musashi's Book of Five Rings, wherever he would pay attention to the way he was focusing on things by way of his visuals and noting the difference between what he called ken and kan sight. One of them had to do with the everyday social mind and how we interact and focus and look at and interpret and name, label, and suggest that things are and they make sense in our world because we've named them and categorized them. And that is what we'd call foveal focus or central focus, but that's also something that we do with a higher level of cognition that occurs in our prefrontal cortex. Yes, it occurs throughout our brain as far as like storage and the signaling and all that good stuff. But for the most part, the higher level cognitive stuff that we do with our brain has to do with naming, labeling, and categorizing. And if we're thinking about the reactive states at speed, whenever things become tense, the military and the police tend to still use this. They're saying it's an outdated mode, but it makes a lot of sense still. And that's the OODA loop or the OODA loop is what it's usually spoken of as, rather, whenever people discuss it. So we observe, we organize, then we decide and act. It doesn't always have to be a dangerous situation, but if there is an interactive quality, there is, by default, an underlying attentiveness to whatever information is coming in through our environment that we're deciding and categorizing and moving along with it at the most basic and simple and stripped down and quick in the sense that something happens and presents very quickly. Now, what does this have to do with attention? Well, a whole heck of a lot, actually, because when we were cave people a long time ago, living in simpler times and we had fewer homes and lived out and about foraging, if we were hunter-gatherers or fortunate enough to be agrarian and living in simple homes and going out to hunt and coming back or doing anything along those lines, we had to be very aware of our environment, not only how we stepped, what it smelled like, what did it look like, where are the tracks, if there are tracks, are there animals out there that are dangerous that are trying to eat us? Well, we're trying to gather something to eat, especially if we need protein. So some very important things. So whenever we're thinking about the observational aspect of the OODA, that is something that we take in not only through our eyes. We take it in through our touch, our tactile, through our smell, our gustation. How does it taste if I'm tasting some smell and something that sets me off and it's like not good? Or even the act part, well, what do you do with that? Well, the entirety of the body is involved as much as it is in the observation part. So we're setting the stage here for some of the things we're going to discuss because we're moving now more towards whenever I am observing, perceiving. Perception is another way of saying attention, but it's coming in through the different sensory aspects of our body, of our vehicle. But it's still attention because it's signaled to be interpreted, to be made sense of, that falls within the OODA, but also gives us information on how to act, how to decide whether or not it's an appropriate action or not, and does it become a very simplistic approach avoid? That could depend on how fast it presents, which is the next part of our discussion here today. So speed of onset of the OODA has to do with how quick the perception comes in. The faster it is, the more apt we are to not be thinking in the sense of naming, labeling, and deciding, but rather more so observing a speed. Is it looming? Is it getting bigger? Which means it's coming in really fast, or is it moving in steadily? I can decide and take my time and maybe even engage my higher cognitive process and then finally act, whether it be to intercept if it looks like something tasty, or in a sense of I have to get out of the way. I don't want to get caught by it, so I better run and take evasive action. So depending on how fast it is, what do we mean by fast? The fast interpretation where we can take in a face or see something moving and identify it is at the lower end, 150 to 300 milliseconds, where we can still consciously decide and determine whether or not it's dangerous to us or if it's somebody that's friendly. 150 to 300 milliseconds. Now, this is at the perceptual level where we're taking in visual information at a distance, mind you, not just the hearing, but more so the visual. And during that 150 to 300 milliseconds, that is where we decide on interceptive or even evasive action. And if it's terrifying enough, we may even freeze at that point. But 150 to 300 milliseconds is incredibly fast. Now, if we have a little more distance and time to think and act, now we're looking at the cognitive process or the prefrontal cortex coming online in the sense that we're using it to decide on what we're going to do and thinking maybe strategically if we can. And this at the 300 millisecond range is pretty fast, but whenever we have the come on of the higher cognitive process, that doesn't really occur till 1.2 seconds. And that's 400 times slower than the initial reception of that 150 to 300 millisecond range impulse where we decide to move before it ever becomes a higher thinking process. So 1.2 seconds, that's 400 times slower. Do the math on it. It's kind of crazy. But there is still an aspect of this that is even faster. There's a portion, depending on how fast things present, that we're not going to be cognitively involved until after the fact, until way after the fact. If we have a presentation of stimulus or something that's coming to get us that is faster than that 150 milliseconds, we're talking between 150 on down to 60 milliseconds. That is whenever it is no longer decided upon friend or foe, but is by default seen as a threat. It doesn't mean it's bad. It just decides it as a threat. So therefore, we move away from it and we will treat it as, I don't want to say enemy, but as a danger. So therefore, evasive action and maybe even defensive action may be instigated. So if something comes in incredibly fast at about 60 milliseconds to 100 milliseconds, more or less, we're talking about an incredibly deep response that way precedes what we would call anything higher cognitive, where we could decide, label, and act. So none of that is occurring. It's strictly at the perceptual organismic level that is fight, flight, in the truest sense. Now, we've already set the stage for the next part of the discussion. Whenever we have things that are sudden onset, and how do we tie this to self-regulation skills? Well, we're moving into the social realm. How do these perceptual attentive qualities interact with our day-to-day interactions with people? Well, depends. You've ever had a friend or somebody that you know jump out from behind a wall and give you the scare and the boo, and you jump back, or you might even strike out before you can even think about it, then we're kind of getting an idea as to the speed whenever it involves other people, that people may jump into our space or come into our visual field or take us by surprise. These are important things to note. Now, we were talking about the cost of attention. Whenever you're seeing something that you've seen before, we take it almost like an average. We become a little more efficient, and we tend to assume it to be regular, especially if it's something that we see on a day-to-day basis. We go in a room, we see a certain cup on a certain desk tilted a certain way, but we come in after somebody's cleaned, and now that cup is nice and straight and facing a different direction, and the logo is no longer facing out, it's facing in. And those little things will capture our attention. They will capture that attentiveness because now it's different. Because we're used to seeing a routine, and that routine gives us not only a sense of comfort, but it's by default efficiency. It is actually a saving of energy because I'm not having to attend to every little single detail like stepping into that brand new forest where we may feel overwhelmed. Whenever these changes occur, that will draw our attention, and we might even have an obsessive feel about it because now, okay, something's different. And our body may even have an increase in heart rate because the room is different. If that's different, what else is different? Then we start going into an inference that is not necessarily correct that says that, wow, if that's different, something changed, that means a lot of things have changed. Maybe other things have changed in here. And that may actually slow us down and paralyze us because now we're engaging our thinking process, but also it's being engaged in a negative sense with what if I can't change what's changed here. I had no control of it. And we feel vulnerable for some reason. Now, whenever we're predictively thinking in a positive sense, well, that may have changed, but somebody may have helped me out, did this and I forgot. But we take it in a more positive spin that tends to open up the possibility, especially if we go up and touch that cup and realize, well, the cup's okay. And we look around and realize, well, if that cup is okay, mind you, I'm touching it. I'm physically perceiving it by tactile sense and visualizing it and then making sense. Then my stress or anxiety may go down because I physically engaged it versus leaving it at the subjective level wherever I can anxiously start thinking about it, where our thoughts are limitless. The number of thoughts are limitless, so That sounds like a positive thing if you're doing good positive things for yourself and improving yourself, but it's not a good positive thing if we're anxiously, subjectively pulling the reins and saying, giddy up, let's go in the direction of anxiety and think as many anxious thoughts as we can and make ourselves nervous and uncomfortable. Well, we can do that. But if we engage our perception, we tend to ground by touching, by feeling, by smelling, and then being willing to suspend immediate subjective judgment, paying attention, doing the attentive thing, not necessarily intentionally focusing, but being aware of all surroundings. And at the same time, not being overwhelmed and hyper-focused by one idea and then allowing our anxious thoughts to run away with themselves. Now, the reason I say it that way is because at that point it becomes almost uncontrollable if we're apt to be anxious. So just some things to think about, things to chew on. Now, one of the things about a hyper-fast presentation of people or things, let's just keep it in the people range right now since we're in the social scheme. If somebody is going through the grocery store and you're bypassing them at a distance, somebody that you know very well, maybe even family, and they're walking by you, we have to take it into consideration if they're in a hurry, if they're walking by, and we tend to assume that they're just being stuck up because they didn't. I waved at them, but they didn't even recognize me. But they're walking around scanning left and right, but they didn't see you. We have to understand that their heart rate is up, their breathing is up. Let's say they're not in the greatest of shape, and they may be all dressed and looking good, but they're kind of nervous and making sure they're putting on a good show. That's a lot to worry about. That is a stressor, but that also kind of narrows the focus to where their direction is that they're wanting to go to get the bread or the fruit or whatever, which means they're probably more foveal focused or centrally focused visually, even though they're not consciously doing it. They're trying. That's why they're scanning, because the faster they move, the more they start losing peripheral visual capacity. So they have to turn their heads left and right. And that means, yes, they have 3D recognition going forward, but it's not meant for motion. But if they're scanning left and right, they can see, but they're seeing things in a blur. And it's not perfectly detailed, and that might be why it looks like they're stuck up and not paying attention to you, because they don't recognize you. We develop a sort of agnosia, no recognition. Now, the actual term for the disorder called prosopagnosia has to do with lack of recognition of faces. And that can be something that's a long-term thing that can be very scary for some people live with that. But do we develop something like that? In a sense, yes, because we're not able to focus in detail and be able to recall that face. Now, the slower we move, and if somebody stops you and touches you and grounds you, you may be able to do that then. But the prosopagnosia thing, not the disorder, but as an effect of motion, yes, it can occur. We can actually not recognize people if we're moving too fast, and they cannot recognize us. So it's not just in me, it's in others too. Mind you, we share a very similar neurological structure. Now, Oliver Sacks, in his book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, spoke of a number of different disorders, neurological disorders, and that prosopagnosia was one, where one could not recognize even somebody that one lives with and knew them. And you can actually misidentify people that you've known for a long time. It's not that you don't know them. It's just that whenever your neurological structure is in dynamic movement, especially a high-speed movement, you're probably not going to recognize them. That's why when somebody jumps out from behind a door and gives you the boo and the scare, you might smack them, you might love them, but at that moment, love isn't happening. That is actually a defensive protective reaction, saying organism live or die. So it becomes overly simplified. So there's a couple of things we have to pay attention to here as far as our structures. The identification of two large pathways, our simpler pathway, having to do with speed of recognition and bringing our more primordial primal reflexes into play, go along the larger pathways called the magno pathway. And magno pathway is kind of large, like a large highway where we have many, many rows of lanes, 10 rows, for instance, like in Los Angeles or bigger, going one direction. That means there's less resistance to the signal going that direction, which means it's a lot faster by default because you have more lanes to go down. Whereas the parvo path, a little more narrow, but that's also one that's involved with higher cognitive reasoning, and it's slowed down and narrowed, and that means that we're able to get those bits of information and make sense of them more easily versus having them run roughshod down a 10-lane highway at high speed that we can't make sense of until it slows down or until it's over. So those two pathways are involved whenever we're doing intentional thinking and paying attention. And then the unintentional attentiveness, where we take in all information that is precognitive in the sense that we're not doing higher thinking, but can also be at a level of liminal conscious, almost subconscious reaction, not purely subconscious, but at a level that's so simplistic and base that it's more our reactivity than it is our intentional involvement in something by way of our conscious effort choosing to do something. Now, there was a book by this author named Kahneman, and he came out with this idea about fast thinking, slow thinking, and they treated it like it was such a novel thing, but fact of the matter, it's not particularly novel, but the fact is that whenever we are thinking slow, that means we're actually reasoning and able to name, label, identify, categorize this entire cognitive process, but also that indicates that probably we're not under what we would call a high degree of environmental stress, where we may feel like the bologna sandwich at risk. Whereas if we're fast thinking, that means it's not really thinking in the higher cognitive sense, but rather making sense of very simple survival signals and determining strategically what's the best option, approach, avoid, mate, fight, eat. Too simple. And those are the two ideas that he put down in his book that people just really highly lauded, but no big mystery there. Now, it is mysterious to some of us when we go through that, if we've never been taught or know about it. But these are kind of the things that we run into, depending on not only attention, but also what we're doing with that attention. Is it a survival orientation? Is it more so a detailed social thing? Now, I started this with the statement cost of attention. What is that cost of attention? There's energy. The more novel things are, the more energy it takes. When you learn something new, have you ever taken a nap because your mind was tired? Or whenever you're studying very hard or profusely, you're trying to pick up new information, your mind gets tired. You physically may not need rest, but your mind needs rest. And we have to realize that our brain burns high-octane fuel at a higher level than what our musculature does when we're in exercise. So the cost of attention is high because whenever we're learning something new, we burn more of that high energy fuel with this little 1 pound gizzard we have floating around in our head. No, it's not a gizzard, but you understand what I'm saying. But it is a high octane engine and it produces very well as a result of burning high fuel. So the cost of attention is high and it can leave you physically exhausted. And if you're already tired, we have lower quality cognitive process, harder to remember, takes more effort, and we don't feel so good. We don't make the greatest of decisions whenever we're exhausted in that sense. So this is what we're going to stop with today, and I want to say thank you for giving me some of your time this Thursday evening. Certainly been a pleasure visiting with you, and this has just been a really fascinating walk down the attentive process and a little bit about structure and time of perception, which are areas I like to talk about. But if you have any questions or feedback, please send them to the Gmail at runningmangetskillsproject@gmail. And I would love to hear from you. And take care, and let's pay attention and walk well.